Please be seated. Paul wrote to the Christian church in Galatia with the idea of liberation from physical things to spiritual things. So, what physical thing was Paul talking about? He was talking about circumcision. Circumcision. And the point he was making in that passionate speech, it was all about freedom, and that the only thing that counts for those who follow Jesus is faith working through love, not circumcision. So if you take anything away from this sermon, that's it. Yeah. Here's a little more of the scripture reading than what we have in the bulletin. I think maybe it helps to sometimes, you know, put the bookends there, right? For freedom, Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to the yoke of slavery. Listen, I, Paul, am telling you that if you let yourselves be circumcised, Christ will be of no benefit to you. Once again, I testify to every man who lets himself be circumcised that he is obliged to obey the law. You who want to be justified by the law have cut yourselves off from Christ. He's using a little metaphor there. You have fallen away from grace. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision counts for anything. The only thing that counts is faith working through love. For you were called to freedom. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for self-indulgence, but through love become slaves to one another. For the whole law is summed up in a single commandment: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. This was a big controversy at the time. Obviously, it doesn't seem to be a big controversy here, but it was then, because anybody who would become a part of the new faith, according to the Apostle Peter, you need to get circumcised. That's what Jews do, you see. But Paul said no, to let the Gentiles, those who are not Jewish, become a part of the new Christian Reformed group. You don't have to be circumcised. There are other things that are more important. Faith working through love. Well, the commandment was reflected in the love sermon last week about the Good Samaritan. And the week before, the love sermon reconstructed that golden rule. Since in its present form, love begins from where you are rather than from where the other person is, and therefore it's been used to justify the forced conversion of infidels all through the centuries. And you may remember that we were talking about a new golden rule, which includes the plurality of all cultures, religions. Do unto others as they would have you do unto them. See how the twist is there. This requires not the sentimental arrogance, assuming you know what is best for others, but it's a willingness to listen and learn from other people and their perspectives. Two love foundations, therefore, the Great Commandment and the Golden Rule, and today we have a third. So this is kind of the end of this three sermon series. That third, it's the love of freedom. Genuine love is free love. Now, when I say free love, I'm not talking about the free love of the 1960s, okay? Free love, it's a costly love only because it is born of freedom. Freedom is not, as Justice William Douglas said in 1952, the right to be left alone. It is not a quality of being like courage or fairness or loyalty. Freedom is a condition which allows us to choose what is right from what is wrong, what is good from what is bad, what is loving from what is hateful. In the power to choose, one finds the condition of freedom. It's not a birthright, it's not a given, it's costly. The very definition of freedom is the ability to make choices and the ability to carry them out. And there are different kinds of freedoms: political, social, in the social, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, academic freedom, due process of law, economic freedom, and that's called capitalism. Likewise, there are limits to these freedoms. Freedom isn't free. In politics, separation of powers divide authority, therefore protect the people from the abuses of the authority. In the social realm, for example, let's use religion, there is freedom, but any religious group, say, practicing human sacrifice, that's a no-no. You can't do that. You see, there have to be these limits. And economic freedom, the freedom of manufacturers, for example, to run their factories as they wish, does not allow them to dump industrial wastes into other people's drinking water. There are limitations to freedom. That is to say, we are not alone in the world. In his Four Freedoms speech to Congress in January 1941, Franklin Roosevelt shared this message. It was just prior to World War II. And he said, "In the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want." Translated into world terms, means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy, peaceful life for all, everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world. That's how freedom operates: freedom of and freedom from. Freedom finds integrity in its limitations. We cannot cut ourselves off from the rest of the world. Little did Roosevelt know that in December of 41, America would be attacked in Pearl Harbor. Now, as our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, as they were playing this past week at the Children's Discovery Museum in Traverse City, by the way, I go there Thursdays, I shared in a discussion with a variety of age groups. And each generation, we were remembering, of all things, here it is coming up on Thanksgiving, particular tragedies. One great-grandparent was just a child when Pearl Harbor was attacked. What a memory that was for him. And for me, it was the Kennedy assassination, for a bunch of millennials, 9/11. I told the group that I was in the fifth grade. I was on the playground, and I remember being called into my classroom. Everything was somber, as our teacher requested that we sit in silence. It seemed like an hour. The rest of the day, I remember the subject. It was on freedom here in America. The Kennedy assassination, it took place on November 22nd, 1963, and it was a Friday. That Sunday, November 24th, today, November 24th, I recall attending worship at our congregational church in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. There were prayers for a country in the midst of the national tragedy. Every Sunday after worship, my family gathered at my grandmother's house for dinner. My grandmother never attended church because she was cooking the meal, and it was a great excuse. She had been married to a congregational minister, and she didn't need any more religion in her life. Upon arriving at Grandma's house, we discovered that my grandmother, she was in a state of shock. Jack Ruby shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald. And it all happened in front of Sunday television audiences, and my grandmother saw the entire shooting unfold. This was in the midst of the Cold War with Russia, and so we discussed whether or not it was a communist plot against our country. We wondered, is Jack Ruby a communist spy ordered to murder Lee Harvey Oswald, another communist spy? Was there a cover-up? One thing for sure, here was an attack on freedom, on democracy, on capitalism. Here it is, 56 years later, to the day, still wondering where freedom has gotten us. Years ago, it was in high school, I was in a play. Yeah, Penny might know a little bit about this play. Our Town, Thornton Wilder. It reminds me of my own upbringing. Now, this was early 1900s. Family church, family dinner, family prayers, family. I was in the play in high school. I played the stage manager. I don't know why they wanted me to play the stage manager, but apparently it was a pretty good role, too. I think Cal Holbrook actually played it. This play was written in 1938 with small-town life characters known as the Webbs and Gibbs. Even the dead in the cemetery come to life. Takes place in Grover's Corner, New Hampshire. I recognize my own life in our town. People may have said that this was a fiction, but I grew up in a town with family and friends, very much like Thornton Wilder's depiction of American life. I was free to do some things. I was not free to do other things. There was free time, school time, there was work time. I was dealt my share of chores, responsibilities, obligations by not only my parents, but also their friends, our church too. So I was not left alone in any sense of the word, but rather I was part of a greater whole, a community of love, and therefore my identity was tied up in something greater than myself. As I was growing up, I wasn't much free to choose whether or not I would attend church or any family gathering. It was something one was expected to do. I not only could not choose another religion, I could not choose going to another church. We were attending the First Congregational Church, period. And by doing this, rather than letting me choose my way, or any way I wanted to go, my parents provided a basis for freedom. During college, I rebelled against church. I refused to attend church. The forced Thursday morning chapel, it had been suspended the year before. Do I resent the fact that my parents restricted my freedom as a child, as a young person? No. Otherwise, what could I have rebelled against? I am therefore thankful my parents forced me to learn a theological tradition which I could rebel against. Besides, look where that rebellion got me. I know that many of you come from a variety of traditions, and some forced you into certain molds that were not too supportive or encouraging. I've heard terms like Roman or roaming Catholic, recovering Protestant. Yet I urge you to think again and to give thanks that people cared enough to provide those religious foundations. Consider that you were educated in a religious tradition, whether a Methodist or Presbyterian or Episcopalian, Unitarian, Trinitarian, liberal, conservative, so that some future time, at some future time or place, you could make that choice freely for yourself. Restrictions actually led to more freedom. It's not only the freedom from, the rebellious freedom, but also the freedom to affirm something greater than self. And I spoke earlier of defining moments in our lives, and all of us as Congregationalists have finding very defining ideas, and they all come out of Thanksgiving. And that's what I wanted to kind of wrap up this sermon. It has to do with a very American holiday, Thanksgiving. That's why I keep saying heritage instead of harvest feast. I was corrected by Catherine this past week. It's harvest, not heritage, John. But I'm used to the heritage, which is in my congregational blood. How many of you come out of the congregational tradition? Two, three, four, five, six, okay, seven, all right. This is the First Congregational Church of Cadillac, and yes, it's the United Church of Christ since 1957. But before that, there's a heritage. And in the ENR, the Evangelical and Reform, there are those churches with saints in front of them, typically, or Zion, or Bethlehem, or something. But when you get a first in there, that's a congregational tradition. And that's what this church is. We have our roots in congregationalism, going way back into 1883 when this church started. More than any other Christian group, our congregational ancestors were those pilgrims who sailed on the Mayflower and settled Plymouth Plantation. Thanksgiving stems from the anti-Anglican English separatists who in 1620 landed at Plymouth, Massachusetts and established a Christian community not governed by king or queen or pope, but of the people, for the people, and by the people. Would be no intermediary between a person and Christ, they said. The congregation would have full authority to run its own affairs. They called themselves the Lord's free people. And they called their churches congregational. That freedom came with a price. Their first winter in New England, it was awful. The challenge of establishing a new colony met with much hardship. More than half of their company died that first winter. And it was known as the starving time, when 5 kernels of corn were apportioned to every adult for a meal. The following year, with the kindness of Native Americans, an abundant harvest was experienced, which became the first Thanksgiving. Incidentally, next year we'll be celebrating the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower Landing, 2020. After rebelling against the authoritarian religion of England, these pilgrims, these separatists, were affirming freedom of worship in the New World. It should be mentioned that the pilgrims were not the only ones on the Mayflower. There were others looking for New World capitalist opportunities, and the pilgrims called them the strangers. And so on this Thanksgiving Sunday, what kind of freedom do we celebrate? Alexander Solzhenitsyn gave a speech in 1978, and he didn't go after Russian communism in his address. You know, he had been imprisoned in Russia, and basically a concentration camp there in Siberia. But instead, Solzhenitsyn deplored the West's obsession with things, goods, material pleasures. And he said, "We have placed too much hope in politics and social reforms only to find out that we were being deprived of our most precious possession, our spiritual life." Here is a person in the land of so-called freedom saying that we were rich in things and poor in soul, in the famous words of Harry Emerson Fosdick's hymn. In a world of individualism, materialism, accumulation, greed, Solzhenitsyn could see less freedom and more bondage in the United States of America. In an essay called "The Great Failure of Capitalism," Sidney Harris, like Solzhenitsyn, calls America to account for its abuses of freedom, being rich in things and poor in soul. And he says this: In all the scathing, and this goes back, by the way, to the 1960s, in all the scathing criticisms that the communists make against capitalist society, they have never put their finger on the one just accusation that can be leveled against us. For the big failure of capitalist society is neither economic nor political, as the communists wrongly insist. It is social, cultural, educational. We have failed to raise the quality of life nearly as much as we have increased the mere quantity of goods and opportunities, the general quality of life in our society. It's low and brutish. The violence we are so concerned about is merely an extension of our incivility, our bad manners, our coarseness of values, our crudeness of sensibility. The original idea of the American Revolution was to raise the level of citizens, to educate them, civilize them, make them responsive to grand ideas, broad sentiments. Americans were to become a different breed of people, but something went wrong along the way. In the process of exercising our economic and political freedom, we somehow forgot that these are just means, not ends. The ends must include a citizenry ruled by reason, ruled by compassion. We have failed dreadfully in this crucial area. Just walk along a crowded downtown street in any big city, and you will see what I mean. Or visit a beach on a hot day. Or drive along a congested highway at any hour. The spirit is sour, it's cheap. Quality of life, disputatious, uncivil, mean, petty. Our massive educational system has not educated. Our inclusive religious establishment has done nothing but magnify the tribalism of our people. And our affluence has merely convinced us that possession rather than decency or merit should be our prime ultimate goal. Most Marxist criticism of us is a mad mixture of malice and ignorance, half-truths and distortions. The kind of capitalism they fulminate against, it disappeared a long time ago. But if they are too dumb to disclose our true defects, we should be smart enough to see them and to take prompt steps to rectify them. For if the quality of American life keeps degenerating, there will be no need for revolution. We will disintegrate from within as our own worst enemies. So he concludes. So our task, our challenge, is to use that freedom so that we do not become slaves to what freedom allows us to obtain. I'll conclude with a few words from Mahatma Gandhi. He warned that false freedom would lead to politics without principle, wealth without work, commerce without morality, pleasure without conscience, education without character, sciences without humanity, worship without action and sacrifice. But I'd better finish on an upbeat note. That's kind of depressing, isn't it? So let's just be upbeat and talk about the loving freedom once again that St. Paul emphasized. Again, the only thing that counts is faith working through love. For you are called to freedom, brothers and sisters. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for self-indulgence, but through love become slaves to one another. For the whole law is summed up in a single commandment: you shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. Amen.